The idea of a spiritual revolution is that we need to completely rethink how we do everything, because these systems are set up on the very worst aspects of humanity. They're set up on aggression and competition and contest and one-upsmanship and self-interest and every man for himself.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Imperfect on Purpose. First of all, thank you so much for the kind words. A lot of you have written me in the last 2 months while the podcast has been on break. We have been moving and settling in Costa Rica, so we needed a little time. Thank you also for the love given to my beautiful wife, Mariam, after the episode we did on the 1st of October. It has been very moving. Just thank you so much. It's so great to feel you and, yeah, just connect with you out there. I will keep you all posted on things going on with the podcast on the different social platforms, so please follow us there. I am currently in the process of figuring out how everything fits together. I am super excited about it. More to come. Also, check out my homepage at lasevive.com for more info, coaching, newsletter, and much more. This week's guest is Rainn Wilson. He is an American actor, comedian, podcaster, producer, and writer. And he is probably best known as Dwight Schrute in the sitcom The Office. Lately, however, he has written the New York Times and Los Angeles Times best-selling book Soul Boom, Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution. And in this book, he explores the problem-solving benefits that spirituality gives us to create solutions for an increasingly challenging world. This conversation covers a wide range of topics, including why existing political and economic systems are not enough to bring the change that the world needs. We also explore the possibility for a spiritual revolution and what's standing in the way of that. Among other things, we also discuss the unconscious life, personal decision-making, gratitude, and the meaning of it all. It was a super day in the studio, and thank you so much, Rainn. Here we go, guys. Enjoy. I recently read your book, Soul Boom, and I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thanks so much. Thanks for reading it.
It's kind of a, you know, I've been on this adventure, Imperfect on Purpose, which is kind of a description of my way to some kind of typical traditional success, whilst having another journey, which is investing in spirituality and my health and my family and my relations, and kind of to get that out in the world that it's possible to take that journey without being completely destroyed as a human. So when I read your book, it spoke to me because I'm on the verge of entering a new kind of period of my life where all of these things that you're talking about, spirituality and community, nature, all of these things are more in focus for me. So I guess what I always do when I have a guest here, I have my sister who is a spiritual advisor. She tunes in a little bit on you and on me.
Okay.
And she kind of gives me where you and I maybe...
where we intersect.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, great. That's wonderful.
Yeah. So the first one she said is the pureness. Like, we don't talk about change. We talk about revolution. The second one is purpose. We are both searching for something better, bigger. She just said childhood. I think we relate in the way that we're both raised in some sort of religion, and we've taken that to a different level maybe for ourselves.
Okay.
And the last thing is the struggle and the conversion between struggle and something that you can use as a human. How do you see those four?
Yeah, so revolution in terms of spirituality, works on essentially two levels. I think it works on a personal level and it works on a societal level. And certainly for myself, and we can get to the struggle part of it, because of struggle in my particular case, and I don't know if we want to go there right now, but mental health issues, depression, anxiety, loneliness, addiction, those struggles led me to a spiritual search that was deeper, I think, than most. The writer Julia Cameron, who wrote The Artist's Way, which is an amazing workbook for artists, she said, "I come to spirituality not out of virtue, but out of necessity." Mm-hmm. So I love that way of putting it, and I feel the same way. Like, I needed to find a spiritual path, and that came out of struggle. So that was my personal spiritual revolution, was a transformation from someone who lived according to the rules of the world at large, according to kind of secular New York artists, and sought, comfort and status, all the usual human pursuits, pleasure. Mm-hmm. And I've, upended that, and I'm on a different path. And I'm not saying I'm awakened or I'm enlightened or I've got anything figured out. I really, really don't. I'm just someone who's on a journey. I'm not any kind of guru I have a little bit of wisdom from experience, but I try in my conversations to be someone like, I am a deeply flawed and beautiful spiritual being inhabiting this weird looking meat suit, for 58 years now, and I'm struggling and I'm on my journey. So that's the personal revolution. But then kind of the thesis of the book in terms of revolution is that the systems, certainly in the United States, are colossally broken and they're built on the wrong foundation. So they are unsustainable. And you take any system you want, agriculture, healthcare, education, certainly politics, we see how broken the political system is. But even the way that you make money and set up businesses, how the economy works, the gross economic injustices that exist, that these issues are not fixable with tweaks. They're not fixable with some legislation or passing a bill or, making some small adjustment here or there. The idea of a spiritual revolution is that we need to completely rethink how we do everything, because these systems are set up on the very worst aspects of humanity. They're set up on aggression and competition and contest and one-upsmanship and self-interest and every man for himself. These kind of more baser animalistic instincts that have driven humanity for eons, we've set up systems like healthcare based on those same tensions, those same dynamics, and it's not working and it's only going to get worse. So that's what I was attempting to do, was provoke a discussion of a revolutionary change, both on an individual level and on a societal level.
I think when industrialism came, I think that's when all of these values started to kind of turn a little bit towards, a lot of greed. I can just say from my own experience that since we've started this project, the amount of people in my inbox, and I'm sure you have it the same, people that are so frustrated and they have no idea how to get out of this jigsaw because they're stuck. They're completely stuck in this wheel where society and Instagram and all of the other platforms are telling them, you're doing great. Well, why am I not feeling great? Yeah. Why am I feeling like shit? It's because you are completely lost within yourself. And that's the biggest dilemma we have right now. That people are just not happy, basically.
Yeah.
So we need so many And this is also why I loved your take in Soul Boom, is because we can't make it kind of a, you know, like a happy go lucky, just love everyone. We have to start from the foundation. We have to start in so many areas and completely rethink our society and the way we go about things.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, follow or subscribe the podcast where you get it. It makes a huge difference to us, and it means that we can keep getting exciting people in the studio and create inspiration to others out there. Thank you so much. Now back to the conversation. So where do we start?
Well, we start by having the conversation, which we're having. And this is something that frustrates me to no end in America. So as a member of the Baha'i faith, which I am, the Baha'is eschew anything involving partisan politics, for example. We're really taught that partisan politics are they're corrupt, they're based on greed and backstabbing and gossip and self-interest and just rife with money and corruption, and just don't even deal with it. Don't pick a candidate, don't put up a yard sign, just don't put any money or time or attention into partisan politics. And so, you know, people ask me about candidates, and they ask me to come to fundraisers, and they, you know, it's very divided politically in the United States, as you know, and that's all well and good. And on the short term, one party might be better than the other, you know, like, oh, well, this party is going to make 80% better decisions than the other party. And the other party is actually going to make some really deleterious decisions that will negatively impact our culture. And that's true. But if you put all your attention and your focus there in this constant, you know, 2-year, 4-year dance of election cycles, fundraising, raising hundreds of millions of dollars, finding the candidate that is the most, you know, aggressive, that attacks the other people better, because those are the candidates that rise to the top are the ones that are best at attacking other candidates. Mm-hmm. And if you're perpetuating a system based in greed and money and backstabbing and one-upsmanship, then you're just, you said before, you're on a wheel, you're on a cycle, and you're just continuing that, mm-hmm. that system. And no one in the United States, and it drives me crazy, no one in the United States is questioning the system itself. It's like kind of, hey, wait, you know, like if we had a sound effect right now, it'd be the needle scratch. Mm-hmm. Like, wait a second, stop, just stop. Mm. Let's not talk about Democrat and Republican. Let's mm-hmm. not talk about Biden and Harris and Obama and Trump. Let's just put all that aside. Like, what are we doing? Mm-hmm. Why are we locked into this system? Is this really the system that benefits 300 million Americans in the best capacity? Let's look at it. Like, why is there money involved? Why are there two parties? Why aren't there 7 parties? Why aren't there 20 parties? Does democracy need to have a party system at all? Hmm. Why not elect candidates based on first choice, second choice, third choice, and not have any party affiliation? Like, let's have a conversation about what a healthy democracy might look like. Hmm. A truly representative democracy where you take moneyed interest out, a democracy that attracts the very best candidates, like entrepreneurs and managers and kind of political and social visionaries to those positions, because they're not attracted now because they have to attack people and they have to just do 2 things really well: raise money, manipulate the media. Okay, it's 3 things, and attack their adversaries. Mm-hmm. And so people that aren't interested in doing that aren't attracted to the political system. So why are we not having that conversation? Mm. No one is having it. They'll talk about like, well, we want to start a third party. Well, it's like, but that's just perpetuating the same system, just adding another party, but not changing the system. Mm. Or they'll talk about, well, we need to limit campaign contributions. It's like, okay, that's important. We should limit campaign contributions, but that's not going to fix things. Mm-hmm. As long as it has the same engine, as long as it has the same dynamism of competition, it's not going to sustain. We have to start having that conversation. And we can have that conversation about pretty much every system that is working in the world. So that's where we begin. But we begin with a revolution and not with tweaks and tiny adjustments and legislation. Mm-hmm. And that's where, and people may say, you might even be listening right now, rolling your eyes and saying, that's idealistic, that's naive. It's like, yeah, but you know what? So what? You know, we have to have that conversation. And that's where it begins.
I mean, all revolutions historically start by people talking, sharing their thoughts, moving together for a common goal. That's a revolution. And I think a lot of it is there are so many agents that are speaking against something like this, changing things, because you have so many interests. One agent could be money. You know, just there are too many people making money from the
existing system.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
the forces of stasis.
Yeah, exactly. And plus the fact that a lot of these people have calculated to which part of the human nature they want to speak to. They're not speaking to your heart. They're speaking to your mind. Mm. They're speaking to your brain. And the brain wants to defend you. It wants to make sure you don't die. So, of course, when someone is telling you, you know, if this happens, you're practically going to die. They're going to steal your job. You can't eat. They're going to steal your bread, basically. Then you're going to go all in. We can't have that happen. So I'll vote for this guy because he spoke directly to my brain. I'm not going to let that happen. Hmm. And when you are talking to people, this is my experience. Like when you're talking about changing on a more fundamental level, on a spiritual level, on a human level, a lot of people will feel comfort in putting you in a special category, which is, you're flower power, or maybe you should use like a flannel shirt when you say that. Stuff like that, you know, like because they want to put you in that category, because idealism is flower power. Idealism is you being crazy for saying, well, you know what? This system isn't working. We should burn it down to the ground and start from scratch. Mm. And that's an inconvenient truth for a lot of people. Mm. And they can't, I mean, with all the things they have going on in their lives, with stress and kindergarten and childcare and just getting food on the table, when you start talking about revolutionizing the whole system, they're like, yeah, that's not going to happen. It's Tuesday. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think hand in hand with that, I'd like to tell a story from Soul Boom, which is when I finished the book, I got to the end and I realized like it was too depressing. It's very easy to talk about how broken things are, but it's very difficult to talk about solutions. So I challenged myself and I came up with a chapter called 10 Pillars for a Spiritual Revolution that are like proactive things that we can do and put our focus on. And one of them is to spread joy and squash cynicism. And that goes hand in hand with what you're talking about. It's not exactly the same thing, but it goes hand in hand. Because, well, let me tell this story. I was a young actor. I was in the 90s in New York City. I was studying with various teachers. I was studied with this very famous acting teacher named Andre Gregory. And he was the subject of this incredible movie called My Dinner with Andre. Did you ever see that?
No.
It's a 90-minute movie of two men having dinner, just having a conversation over dinner.
Okay.
And it's from 1979. It's absolutely brilliant, and it holds up today, to this day. It's one of my favorite films. So Andre would meet with his acting students, and he met with me at his apartment. And he, you know, he checked in, we had tea, and we were talking about acting. And he's like, so, you know, he's so great. How are you? How are you feeling? How are you feeling about the work and acting? And And I was like, oh, Andre, I don't know. I'm just feeling really depressed these days and just down about the world. And it's so, you know, the corruption and I'm overwhelmed and the materialism and it just feels so hopeless. And we're headed in the wrong direction. And, you know, I shared what was on my heart as someone in his mid-20s at the time. Mm-hmm. And this was the 90s, and things actually were a lot better in the 90s than they are now. And he was maybe 80 years old at the time, and he reached out. I'll never forget it. He grabbed my arm hard, and he looked in my eyes. He said, don't do it. I'll never forget this conversation. He's like, don't. You cannot be cynical. You cannot afford to be pessimistic. They want you to be cynical. They want you to be pessimistic, because then you'll just sit on your couch and you won't do anything. You have to be hopeful, and you have to spread joy, and you have to come up with ideas, and you have to follow a path. If you sit in your cynicism and your pessimism and your sarcasm, nothing will get done. Mm-hmm. And he was like, now get out of here. And he like kicked me out of his house. And I stumbled out of his apartment in Greenwich Village and walked down the street. And that stayed with me to this day. And it's one of the most valuable lessons I had. It's very easy to sink into like, oh, this all shit and that's crap. And this is fucked and this isn't going to work. And, to live in that mode. Mm-hmm. And those forces that you were talking about, the forces of the brain, of the mind, the forces that are materialism, the forces that are making a lot of money off of the current system, mm-hmm. and profiting from how the system currently works, they want you to stay cynical. Mm-hmm. And they control the news media, and the news media wants you to stay afraid and cynical and small and mm-hmm. pessimistic. And we, no matter who we are, artists, spiritual thinkers, entrepreneurs, people raising a family. Mm-hmm. We can't succumb to that.
Yeah.
That's part of the revolution.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
it's revolutionary to be optimistic. It's revolutionary to be proactive and to try and offer solutions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's probably one of the biggest lies we're told. They want to keep you in your place, and they want to tell you that it's not simple. And the fact is that it is simple. It is actually pretty simple. Mm. And I mean, one of the main points that I've made at this table as well, and in my book, is, you know, you have to recognize that everyone that you meet on your path, they're all improvising. They're all just trying to live their best life with the knowledge they have. And no one, I have certainly never met anyone, knows what happens when we die. No one knows what happens in 10 minutes. I'm pretty sure we're going to be sitting here, but I'm not sure. I can't be 100% sure.
Sure.
And that's just the hand that we have been dealt.
There's a comet right now making its way down to planet Earth, headed to suburban Copenhagen, and it's about to land in 7 minutes. Mark my words. And hopefully we get it on tape and
yeah, it was great to have you here today.
Yes, right? Thank you. Now, our Father who art, exactly. Let's say our last rites.
You're a breath of fresh air. Yeah, doomsday is coming. All right. Well, no, but what I'm saying is that it's just so important that within that frame that you recognize the fact that these are the facts. And you can actually decide whether you want to go left or you want to go right. And I'm not talking politically here. Mm-hmm. I'm talking your life. Mm-hmm. I'm talking how do you want to be? Mm-hmm. How do you want to be perceived? Mm-hmm. How do you want to raise your kids? Mm-hmm. How do you want to spend your time? Are you going to be looking at everyone else thinking, why don't I feel that way? Why don't I have a car? But the fact is, you don't know what that guy in that car is thinking. He might be in the worst peace of mind he's ever been in. And you don't know. So just live your life. And I just think it's so important that we teach, especially our young kids, that they don't have to live in a world where all of these agents are deciding the agenda.
Very well said.
Hey, follow us on social media. The goal is to make content with purpose, inspired by the conscious mindset, mixed with adventure and, of course, my thoughts. Find us on Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn, and Facebook under Lasse Vive. Thank you. Now back to the conversation. I want to switch gears a little bit.
Okay.
Rain. So I kind of want to dig a little deeper into who is Rain Wilson.
Okay.
Let's go.
What do you want to know?
Everything.
Oh, dear God. how much time do you got? As Walt Whitman said, I contain multitudes. Every human being does. But I guess let's go back to the very beginning. I was raised by incredibly dysfunctional parents who were bohemians. I won't say they were hippies. They were on the hippie side of the spectrum, but they were more artsy than they were hippie. They didn't have long hair and they took showers. They didn't do drugs. I grew up as a member of the Baha'i faith. So that was cool in a lot of ways. It was, you grew up learning that women and men were equal and powerful in maybe different ways than society tells us that they're equal and powerful. That social economic and just social justice issues have a spiritual component to them. That racism is one of the biggest kind of crimes that humanity is perpetrating on itself. That science and religion, science and faith, are in harmony. They're two wings of the same bird. They're two different lenses to look at reality. Mm-hmm. They're not, you don't choose faith or science. They work in harmony. It was a diverse community. There was a lot of songs. There was a lot of camaraderie and beauty in the Baha'i faith in the 70s especially. But there was great dysfunction in my family. My mom had left when I was about 2 years old. She took off. I didn't really see her again until I was about 14. And my dad remarried, and they were very unhappy together. So I was growing up in this religious faith that was all about love and unity and peace and harmony. And my family unit was incredibly dysfunctional with anger and pain and resentment and bitterness and fighting and dysfunction and no love and no harmony. So it was, as they say in American English, it was a colossal mindfuck. Mm. It was just a mindfuck of the highest degree. So I grew up in that milieu where I'm like, oh, I love these things that my faith stands for, but what? Oh, my parents don't hug. What's up with that? Like, it was this incredible disconnect. So I think, and it took me many decades to kind of unpack that, but I think that's one of the central, I think the abandonment by my mother and then this kind of weird mindfuck dysfunction in my family was kind of the central to my identity later on. And fortunately, my family really encouraged the arts, and I did lots of arts growing up. I painted and drew. I did music. I was in orchestra. I was in jazz band. I sang. And then when I started acting, I found acting, and they supported me as an actor. And I went to college and studied acting. And I moved to New York City when I was 20. And I've been acting ever since. So that's 38 years that I've been, acting professionally for 30 some. Mm. So that's chapter one. And then chapter two that I alluded to was mental health issues and a great deal of anguish around those issues. that forced me to go to walk a spiritual path in order to seek balance and meaning in my life. Like I said, I don't come to spirituality out of virtue, but just out of necessity. So those are the two defining things in my life. And then you could say, well, my professional career as an actor, doing theater in New York, doing classical theater and Shakespeare for many years, and then doing comedy and improv and sketch comedy, and then going to LA and doing film and television, and then getting on The Office, and then doing TV and film, and now more podcasting and writing in addition to that. So those are the kind of the various kind of facets, I would say. Like if you're distilling Rainn Wilson like a bullion cube, those are the three bullion cubes you put in hot water and melt to make Rainn Wilson soup. And that was a terrible analogy, and I apologize.
How do you see, is there a red thread between that kind of disturbing childhood, your mental issues, and then returning to the faith?
Yes, it's a spiritual journey. It's we all have that journey to some degree. Everyone has to deal with trials and tribulations in some way. And everyone has struggles, and we find ways to get through those struggles. Sometimes we medicate ourselves, and, you know, we drink ourselves and smoke ourselves and eat edibles until we pass out and wake up and have tons of caffeine in the morning to counteract those effects. And, you know, we can numb out and escape with, you know, video games and television, or workaholism and just making money. The contemporary society is kind of set up to allow us to just kind of live in that mode, like a hamster on a materialistic hamster wheel. And sometimes we're forced to get off that wheel and, you know, discover ourselves. So, you know, I'm grateful for my mother leaving me. I'm grateful for a dysfunctional family. I'm grateful for addiction issues. I'm grateful for mental health issues, because it's allowed me to come to this point having this conversation with you. It's allowed me to write Soul Boom. It's allowed me to share my journey with millions of Office fans and spiritual seekers and adventurers, and have brought some wisdom. Did I suffer along the way? Yeah, I suffered a lot. I've gone through a lot, and I've felt an incredible amount of pain. A lot of it I brought on myself. But isn't that the juicy stuff of being a human being? Like, we get to feel pain, and we get to transform that pain into light.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably one of the biggest paradoxes in life, right? Is that all of the things that we struggle with, I mean, if you're able to turn that around, it can be your biggest asset as a human. You know, it's, I mean, I remember in my 20s, I had so much shame about my father's death, because I could feel that the almost the sacrifice that he made, he died from cancer. So it's not something he decided to do. But him dying made me ahead a lot of, I was ahead of a lot of people the same age as me, because I had been confronted with something so conclusive as death. No, I saw death.
How old were you?
20. And just that reflection on how life can be concluded like that.
Yeah.
Is very, is something that makes you reflect on life. And I'm not saying that I, the day after his death, was just super reflected and, oh yeah, this is what life is all about. No, I started running, and I was running for 11 years, just running and running and running, and medicating myself and drinking and smoking and doing all this, the stuff I could do to forget everything while working on being rich, basically, right? Doing all the things that I was expected to do.
Which is another form of running.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. at the age of 31, I meet this lady that you just met, my wife, and it made me turn around and look myself in the eyes. And I can assure you that, which you know, I mean, there's no limitation. Those issues and those pains and all that heartfelt, it doesn't grow old. It stays in there. So when you go in there and you start working on that, it's like it happened yesterday. It's so new and it's so fresh and it hurts so bad. But when you deal with it, you come out on the other side and you're, at least I was, able to give her what she needed, which was love. I could be the father that I wanted to my kids. Mm. And I could actually dive into a life where all of these thoughts that I hadn't really recognized since my father's passing, but I understood now, okay, this is what life is about. Mm. It's about love. It's about family. It's about relations. It's about doing what you love. And yeah, it completely changed my life.
Mm. Mm. That's beautiful. That's great. That's a great story.
Yeah.
It's a love story.
Yeah, I'm corny like that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's great.
But I to go back to the people that write me, I'm aware that you can't just say turn around and look yourself in the eye, because it's the hardest thing I've ever done. Hmm. It was so painful. Hmm. So to tell someone to do that, it's almost like an assault. You know what I mean? Hmm. You're trying to make this person do something that is so painful. Hmm. And why would you do that? So you have to take the long game. You have to, well, on the other side of that, the worst travel you've ever been to, that's where paradise is.
Well, that's, you know, what you're talking about is a spiritual idea that's in every faith tradition, which is has to do with the nature of suffering and the importance of suffering and the centrality of suffering, difficulty, tests, what have you. This is one of the main pillars and the problems, I believe, with the mental health epidemic right now with young people, is an inability to understand suffering, because all of the external prompts tell us that we shouldn't be suffering and suffering is real, or if you're suffering, something's wrong with you. And so young generations don't know how to deal with suffering. In the Baha'i Faith, Abdul Baha, the son of the founder of the Baha'i Faith, said at one point, like, let your children become accustomed to suffering. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't want to take away difficulties and suffering. We want them to get used to it as they're growing up. Mm. We don't want to perpetrate it on them, but as they say in the United States, there was a famous book called The Wisdom of the Skinned Knee. What we learn from skinning a knee. Don't take away a child's ability to skin their knees and learn from that pain. Mm-hmm. In Buddhism, suffering, the first teaching of the Buddha is that there is suffering. Life is suffering. The Sanskrit term is dukkha, which most literally translates to anxious discontent. So life is anxious discontent. There is an unsettled dissonance inside us as human beings. As very few people I've met who are just like blissfully just happy without in some kind of internal conflict. Mm-hmm. So, and then difficulties come from our own making, and difficulties come at us without our asking for them. Your father got cancer. That's the last thing you and your family wanted. It just happened, and it was like a lightning strike to your family. If we have a deeper understanding of suffering, that I think what the Buddha was getting at is that this this physical realm, this plane that we live in right now, because I do believe that we are spiritual beings having a human experience. I'm a spiritual being. I'm in a flesh suit for 80 or 90 or 100 years, hopefully. And part of my journey is to feel discomfort and pain along the way. That's just how it's rigged up. Some people get, their kid gets cancer or their wife gets hit by a bus or something like that. And they're like, they blame it on God. And they view that, oh, it's God's fault. Fuck you, God. I don't believe in God. You know, that's so unfair. You know, they're innocent. But that's really the wrong conversation, as opposed to bad shit happens. It happens all the time. It happens to the innocent. It happens to us. It happens in so many different ways. And how do we process that? How do we accept it? And how do we go through it? And how do we transform suffering into light? And of course, the Buddha's whole thing was like, suffering comes from attachment to things, to outcomes. And if we release our attachments, if we become non-attached, that we lift suffering from us. There's other paths one can walk, but I think that's a very valuable teaching, especially for young people, for kids and young adults, to understand that we can't be the number one law of physical reality is change. Things are changing all the time. Our bodies are changing right now. They're deteriorating in certain ways, and trees outside are dying and trees outside are blooming. And there is this circle of life, and this is part of the human condition. And social media doesn't help, because social media only seems to capture the beautiful and the good and the most curated, elevated moments of people's lives. So you look on Instagram and everyone's happy and smiling and dancing and vacationing and looking amazing with these filters. And, you know, there's a 17-year-old girl who cuts herself and has an eating disorder and is looking at this Instagram and going, what the hell? But so that's not doing us any favors. But I think that a deeper understanding of suffering, the nature of suffering, why we suffer, and how to transform suffering into light is part of the spiritual revolution.
Yeah. And it's such a hard journey, as I said before, you know, like convincing people to do that. It's a hard sell. It's really a hard sell.
We can't convince people to do it.
No.
You know, we can share our stories, and we can share, you know, wisdom traditions, I think, and then people will take from it as they will, and people are always just going to do what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we are wired for self-interest. I also believe that the spiritual component of ourselves and the spiritual makeup of ourselves, we can be wired for other interest instead of being self-interested, other interested. But that's a big struggle too, because we live in a culture of self-interest, and we live in a psychology of self-interest. And that's ultimately, it doesn't lead to happiness. It doesn't lead to joy.
No, but I, you know, these people that are living this hamster wheel life, if you've never tried anything else, and if you hear these people talking about, well, there's another reality over here, you actually have a chance to do this and this and this. And they're saying, you know, like, I'm just trying to make ends meet here.
Yeah.
And you're talking to me about spiritual revolution.
Yeah. And that's an important thing to say right here, because people can be listening right now and go, well, here's two rich guys talking about transforming their lives and, you know, doing X, Y, and Z. But I'm, you know, I've got three kids. I'm twice divorced. I'm $50,000 in debt. I'm working 14 hours a day trying to keep the lights on. So shut up, you know, like, and I get it. You know, I have been there. I'm sure you have been there as well.
Very much.
And so I do think that needs to be honored too.
But what I always say is that, which is also written in my book, you know, like I didn't get wealthy in any form of shape before I started dealing with these things. I didn't know that I thought I was good at my job until I found myself, and then I became extremely good at my job. So what the hard sell can also be, because you also have to speak into things that people understand. Like to say love is the answer and, you know, we are going to fly away in a big rainbow. No. I mean, for me, spirituality, reflection, love, all of these things, they have made me wealthy, if anything. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because
so it's like a false dichotomy of like, oh, you need to get wealthy before you think about spirituality or something like that. But if you think about a spiritual transformation, whatever that means, a meditation practice, you know, merging with nature on a closer level, finding a religion that speaks to you, or a spiritual teacher that speaks to you, whatever it is, it's a false dichotomy that you have to like have made it before you do that, because you're right. I think that's a really important point. Internal transformation on spiritual evolution inside can open up incredible possibilities.
Yes.
And I feel that same way about therapy. And a lot of people are like, well, I can't afford therapy. I can't afford $150 a week or $200 a week for a therapy session. You know, that would put me in debt or whatever. It's like, yeah, but if you get the right therapist and you're in the right, on the right therapeutic journey, that investment can pay off 100-fold. Because if that therapist with your work can unravel the things that are keeping you stuck and psychologically pull those threads and open up possibilities in your life where you're no longer a victim to the choices that you're making over and over again. There's incredible wealth to be found. There's incredible peace to be found and possibility to be found for that investment of $150 a week or a, you know, a couple times a month or what have you. Now there's a lot of bad therapists out there that are not very helpful, so you have to find the right one. But that was invaluable to me. There, I've had some shitty therapists, and then I found some really good therapists, and that has helped me tremendously. And I see it as part of my spiritual journey. I don't think there's a distinction between therapy and a spiritual journey. We're seeking to know ourselves, right? There's lots of different ways to know ourselves. We can know ourselves through sport. We can know ourselves through hiking and being in nature. We can know ourselves through being of service. We can know ourselves through examining the trauma of our youth with a therapist. We can know ourselves by praying and meditating and studying spiritual wisdom and going on a spiritual path. They're all different facets of ourselves that can lead to great possibility.
Yeah, and it's the hen and the egg, you know. It's sometimes people are, they're overwhelmed. And I always try and serve this dish super simple. Like, it doesn't take a lot. Like, you don't need to, you know, sometimes when you watch social media, you need to get up at 5 o'clock and then you need to cold plunge and then you need to swim and then you need to breathe and then you need to nature and then sun in your eyes for 45 minutes and you have to eat eggs and, you know, all these things that you have to do. And what I'm saying is that, you know what? If you can just get up 5 minutes earlier and go for a little walk, then you've started your evolution.
Right. Yeah.
Like, that's all it takes.
Yeah.
Because then when you actually go for that walk, then next week, maybe you'll walk 10 minutes. And I mean, we underestimate completely how much we can change by just little tiny tweaks.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, you're sitting there and you're breathing and you're thinking, you're prioritizing. You don't have to cold plunge, but you're actually moving somewhere.
Sure.
In your mind.
Yeah. All you have to do is look at your screen time on your phone, you know, screen time, how much you spend. I look at it, I'm like, oh my God, I spend that many hours a day on my phone. And a lot of it is watching YouTube videos. Like, can I watch 10% less YouTube videos and take that time toward contemplation, toward communion and connection, I think I can.
Yeah. And it starts with you. And you know what? Before you know it, your partner will do the same. And then when the real good stuff happens, that's when your kids, they start watching you. And they go, okay. Because they're watching you all the time. They're looking at you, you know, obsessing on your phone and watching TV until exactly the moment when you go to bed, and no presents, and you eat like, you know.
Eat standing up at the kitchen, looking at your phone, shoveling food into your mouth.
You don't communicate. You don't do anything. And this is just, I mean, this is generational in such a way that this is how we do it in our family. So that's how they're going to do it. And then their kids are going to do it. And then on and on we go.
Hey, if you want to try one-to-one online authentic life coaching with me, I have a few spots opening up. Do you want to get more clear and conscious on where you're going, what you really want in your life, and how to execute it? Then write me an email on mail@lasevive.dk and we'll set up a free call to explore the options. Thank you. Now back to the conversation.
Who specifically and what specifically is the opposition of this soul boom, of this revolution that we're, I mean, luckily I can feel that we are so many soldiers in this peaceful army right now. Like there is a movement. I can feel that. I mean, there are so many people that want this, but they don't know how to. So what's keeping us locked in here, and who and what?
That's a great question. That hasn't been posed to me before. I don't know that I have the answer to that, but I'll just take a stab at it. I think there's a lot of myths that are perpetrated by Western civilization, and they're incredibly damaging to us. There's a myth that... I think the myth of materialism is maybe the most corrosive. What do I mean by materialism? Materialism works on a number of different levels. Materialism is, like I want to accrue stuff. Like if I accrue stuff, it will make me happy. Well, if that was the case, then rich people would be happier than poor people, and they're not. Now, I have been very poor. I grew up very poor. My family, I mean, very poor. My family, I had to get my clothes from the Salvation Army, and we couldn't afford like milk every week. So I had powdered milk instead of regular milk. Just as an example. And I was a poor actor, and I never made over $20,000 in a year for 10 years as an actor, scrambling as an actor. So I have been without money. But there's a larger myth about materialism that, and I think this is very prevalent in secular Denmark and in secular Scandinavia, that there is nothing else other than atoms and molecules. So I want to accrue stuff to make me happy, and all there is stuff. If you really believe, and that at the end of our lives, when our consciousness goes out in this plane, like that, it's like a candle going out and that's the end. And there's a certain amount of despair. I don't care what you say or what you believe. There has to be a certain amount of despair if that's what one thinks. So then it's like that perpetrates even further materialism. It's like, well, I'm going to get more stuff and just kind of experience the material world to even greater degrees. And you can kind of fool yourself and say, well, I'm just living my life in the moment and living to the best of my capacity and enjoying it because I don't know what's going to happen. And that's all fine and good. But so I think what this worldview does is it takes what is sacred and what is divine out of the experience of living. If you see a tree in all of its beauty, and you witness yourself, you know, on a deeply contemplative basis, mm. where you recognize that, oh, I'm actually not separate from this tree. Mm-hmm. And this tree has a divine beauty inherent in it. And in it, you know, the tree came from a tiny seed. The potentiality of this acorn became this mighty tree. Mm-hmm. And the sun refracted in its leaves is a beautiful spiritual metaphor of the divine source shedding its light through creation, and that we're all connected, and that beauty and transcendence and love are all that urge toward something higher. I'm really monologuing right now, but my point is that this bill of goods that, like, get more stuff, then you'll be happy. Get a house in the suburbs, then you'll be happy. Get a wife and kids, then you'll be happy. You know, retire, then you'll be happy. That there is only stuff in the world, and getting more of it and having increased pleasure, having increased comfort and increased status is going to make us happy. That's the in my mind, the biggest myth. And what I have found joy is in quiet contemplation, in connection with spiritual ideas, in service to others, in connection with my wife and my family, in connection to nature, where my ego and self-will have been abnegated and replaced with, being more other-centered and more connection-centered. That's where I've found joy, meaning, and richness in my life. Mm. And that's where I find myself increasingly turning to. Now, I have a big ego. I have problems with my ego and my self-will. But it's something in that dance around materialism versus spiritualism that, to me, is the biggest, that's the biggest enemy. Mm-hmm. And how is that perpetrated? By advertising, by marketing. Mm-hmm. You know, I have so much fun raising my child watching TV ads, and I wouldn't fast forward through them. We'd watch each one. I'm like, hey, what are they trying to sell you? And how are they trying to sell it to you? Oh, they make you think that if you have a Coca-Cola, you'll be happy. Mm-hmm. Oh, look at this one. They make you think that if you buy a BMW, oh, then you will, mm-hmm. your friends will look up to you. And like, oh, look at this one. Look, Rolex watches are being sold at Wimbledon. Oh, why do you think that is? Oh, because wealthy people, you know, it's aspirational. And like, mm-hmm. to just discuss kind of how materialism seeps in mm-hmm. To the groundwater. There's a lot more to be said there. People may disagree, but I think all of the great spiritual teachers, from Jesus Christ to the Buddha to Eckhart Tolle to the great writers and thinkers, the great swamis and theologians and armchair philosophers and people in 12-step programs, mm-hmm. see that, you know, the richness of the life is built on connection and not on accruing stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but we are brought up with TV, all of us, and we are brought up believing in our politicians. We are brought up believing in ads, as you say. Mm-hmm. And I'm just saying that I completely agree with you, because there's a thing with ego and purpose, how we kind of divide those two, because those two can also be friends in a way. But let me just start by saying, you know, I get it. I get it why it's so hard to deny materialism, consumerism, because, I mean, I don't drink, but when I take my bike down the street, and I see a gin tonic commercial, I'm like, that looks good.
Yeah, it looks good.
That looks goddamn good.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, it's not for me, but I can understand
sure
why people are drinking. Mm-hmm. Because like in bus stands where kids are standing and they see this thing and, I mean, it's socially acceptable. And they see, yeah, as you say, Coca-Cola, BMW, all of these things. And they look so happy, these people, and they're pretty. That must mean they're doing great.
Sure.
That's great. And I'm not going to lie, you know, my ego has taken me a long way. And I'm sure it's the same for you. Mm-hmm. You know that, I mean, but it's, as I said before, when ego and purpose started walking hand in hand, and the things that I assumed would make me happy, my ego was telling me, this will make you happy. Money will make you happy. All of these material stuff will make you happy. But as soon as purpose came into the picture, I mean, you're never going to hear me say that it's wrong to buy something for yourself. I'm never going to say that. I'm just saying that's not the thing that'll make you happy. It's because the purpose of getting there, the journey towards where you are in your life, mm-hmm. that's gonna make you happy. And that's why ego and purpose they should be friends, actually.
Yeah. That's very well said, ego and purpose. I hadn't thought about that before and that alignment. And actually, my next book is going to be kind of a tongue-in-cheek exploration of the meaning in life, a meaning of life. Hmm. So, you know, the meaning of life, according to Rainn Wilson, it'll be a little bit absurd. But I think that goes very much in line with the message that I want to make. Let's go back to the Buddha for a second, because I always like to bring it back to the great spiritual teachers and spiritual traditions. And the reason you go into a Chinese restaurant and you see a fat Buddha sitting there is because the Buddha was an ascetic. So he gave up, you know, food and drink and having stuff, and he lived in a cave and starved himself looking for nirvana. And when he achieved nirvana under the bow tree, the first thing he did is he threw a big feast for all of his followers. And he realized, like, you don't need to starve yourself to have, you know, a spiritual transformation. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's the fat Buddha. Like, you can enjoy the things of the world, but how do you do that with a way where you're not attached to the things of the world? Mm-hmm. That's, again, the non-attachment thing.
Yeah.
And that's very much in the Baha'i faith as well, to, like, it's fine to make money. It's, in fact, entrepreneurs who create jobs for others are greatly praised in the Baha'i faith. And wealth that you make that you didn't inherit, right? Big difference. Mm-hmm. You didn't inherit wealth, but you made it on your own in the arts and in the sciences and in business. That's incredibly praiseworthy in the Baha'i faith. Again, as long as you are not a slave to it, as mm-hmm. long as you are able to live without it, or able to live in detachment from the things of this world, and understanding that we're on a spiritual and divine mission. Mm-hmm. And alongside that, I recently got to visit Dharamshala, India, and I got to meet the Dalai Lama very, very briefly, but to be in a session with the Dalai Lama, which was really beautiful. And all he talked about was love, by the way. That's all he just talked about. Whatever question he was asked, he just talked about love, love, love. Well, how do we do this? And how do we navigate this? And what will happen in the future here? And he just made it love, love, love. But I got to meet another Tibetan monk who I got to interview for my podcast. And then I posed him a question. I was like, listen, bro, pretend you're a monk. You're living in a cave, the top of a mountain. I'm a seeker. I'm climbing up the mountains in the Himalayas, 15,000 feet. I'm getting to the top. I finally reach you. And like, like, oh, wise master, what is the meaning of life? I'm like, you have spent your whole life in monasteries, studying, meditating, praying, connecting. What is the meaning of life? Tell me the meaning of life. And this monk was like, yeah, it's very simple. Serve others. Mm. Serve others. Mm. When you serve others, it actually makes you happy. And this is this is scientifically proven. And this is part of that myth I was talking about before. The myth is that if we serve ourselves, we will become happy. Mm-hmm. In actuality, kind of the... Now, of course, we have to have a certain measure of self-care and we have to have a job and we, you know, we need to take care of our family and pay our bills and we clean ourselves and, you know, we have to have a certain level of self-care. You know, the analogy is when you're on an airplane and there's a disaster and the masks fall down, you put the oxygen mask on yourself first so that you can serve other people. You can put it on the children and stuff like that. So we have to serve ourselves first, but living in service to others, the data points in the positive psychology movement are abundantly clear about how much joy and deep, rich satisfaction that gives us. And we're helping other people, duh. So we're making the world a better place. And if everyone was wired to be in service, which again has to do with every faith tradition from Buddhism to Christianity to Islam to the Baha'i faith. In the Baha'i faith, it's said that work in the spirit of service is worship in the eyes of God. Mm. The idea that when we work, if you're doing this podcast to make yourself famous and make yourself money, maybe not so much. If you're doing this podcast to be of service to the people that write you, to be of service to your community, that is literally worship. That's the same as like getting in a church, kneeling and going, oh God, I love you, or oh God, forgive me, or whatever. That there, it's redefining what worship is in service. Mm-hmm. So if service is worship and service is the most fulfilling, and if service will transform the world, then that's where it goes. Like you talked about distilling it down like a 5-minute walk in the morning. I would say part two, have a 5-minute walk in the morning, part one. Part two, do something nice for someone else. Mm. That's it.
That's it.
Just hold open a door, buy a coffee, call your aunt who's sick and say, I love you. Text someone and say, I miss you. Whatever it is, super simple. Someone is sad, buy them a little card. And then eventually that's going to go further. And then eventually you're going to be serving the poor. Eventually you're going to be on a nonprofit board raising money. Eventually you're going to have ideas about whatever cause is most important to you. You know, the environment and climate, animal rights and animal rescue, veganism, whatever, whatever it is, social justice issues, race issues, immigration issues. You'll find yourself tiptoeing toward ever more service, and your life, your ego, and your meaning will be completely working in tandem. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's there's nothing wrong in saying, you know, I don't have the time, but then again, we all have time, and it's all about prioritization. Mm-hmm. It's priorities. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. Mm-hmm.
I think that we talked about, you know, having these conversations where we're looking at our personal choices and we're looking at our society's choices, humanity's choices, skeptically, with forgiveness, with compassion, but with great clarity. So that's part one. I like the 5-minute walk in the morning. To me, that leads toward a life of contemplation, taking some time for my meditation practice is extremely important to me. I combine it with a prayer practice. I know some people have a difficulty with that idea of God, an idea of prayer, but to me, they're two sides of the same coin. It's prayer is beseeching the universe, thank you for what I have, gratitude, awe and wonder, look at the beauty of these trees. And, you know, help me, you know, help me, source, spirit of the universe, oh, divine beauty, help me on my path, help me find my path. And then meditation is receiving and just being open, like like a satellite dish to taking that in. I find for myself, meditation is like rebooting your computer, like your computer's on the fritz and it's just doing things and you're like, what the hell is going on? And then you... Oddly, you reboot it, and then a minute, and then it goes boom, and comes back on, and all of a sudden, it's working again. Like meditation, even in a 5-minute increment can be like rebooting your computer. It gives me great increased focus and clarity. We do a personal... Here's a point I want to make. All too often in contemporary society, people view spirituality as a form of self-care, as a set of tools to reduce anxiety and to increase connection. That's fine. That's fine and good. The problem is it stops there. So it's, we're being consumerist. It's like, oh, I need to get from point A to point B. I'm going to buy a Toyota to drive me there. I'm feeling too much anxiety and stress in my life. I'll do some spiritual practices. I'll go to yoga class and I'll get a meditation app and I'll read an Eckhart Tolle book. And that will reduce my anxiety and my stress. We're like consuming something in order to get something out of it.
Yeah.
Now, that's not where it stops. And again, going to Buddhism, there's this idea that we, and especially in the writings of Thich Nhat Hanh, we achieve connection and peace and serenity in ourselves so that we can serve others, so that we can have increased compassion and that our compassion leads us to action, to making the world a better place. So I would say the Soul Boom revolution starts internally with using spiritual tools to kind of align ourselves to the beautiful, serene spirit of the universe so that we can be of service to others.
Yeah. And my experience, at least with your words, is that all of these things are available. You don't need to invest anything. Your breath, it's free of charge. You know, you have the nature, it's free of charge. And you have your legs, hopefully, and they are free of charge. So there you go.
And even meditation, you don't need to pay, you know, TM hundreds of dollars a month. You don't need to buy apps or books or anything like that. You can just sit and notice your breath and quiet your mind. It's that simple. Sitting and being quiet and open is free to all.
And then, you know, mix in, you know, change the way you speak to yourself. You know, be positive to yourself. Try and, I mean, I do this little crazy stuff that I've done for 20 years. You know, when I look myself in the mirror, I always give myself a little pat on the back. And, you know, I still to this day feel like an idiot. But then I laugh about it. And that's actually, it just makes it better, actually.
When I first got into therapy about 20 years ago or so, my therapist said, you know, do you ever do self-affirmations, which is similar to what you're saying? I was like, no. And he's like, well, I think you should say three self-affirmations every morning. He goes, I have this list of self-affirmations. I want you to hang it on your bathroom mirror. And because everyone looks in their bathroom mirror first thing in the morning and you see it, you pick your three affirmations that you say to yourself that day. And I picked up the page, and number one was, I am enough. And I was like, well, I'm not saying that one. And he's like, oh, what was that? I was like, the one, I am enough. Oh, I can't even say that. And he's like, oh, okay. So forget the three. Let's just say that. Hang this up on your bathroom mirror and just say, I am enough. And that was powerful. And it took me 10 years to learn how to say and feel and take in, I am enough, to just look in the mirror and say, I am enough.
Yeah. Yeah. And you are. We are.
Everyone is.
Everyone is. And they fool themselves into thinking that they're not.
Everyone is enough, and everyone has what they need.
Yeah. And just breathe into it. Breathe into it. And you know, no people, like, we're all different, but we're all the same. So find your way. It doesn't necessarily have to be a pat on the back. I mean, I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and run around like a crazy guy. You don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. That's just my way, because I know that from 5 to 7, that's when I roll. I mean, that's my best hours in the day. Mm. If yours are 8 to 10 in the evening, well, I mean, go nuts.
Right.
And just find your way. Mm. But breathe, do service, and then speak like you're the goddamn king. Right?
I love that. That's great. That's great.
Rain, it's been a huge pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being here. What a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, I love what you're doing right now. It's really inspiring, and yeah, thank you.
Well, thanks for checking out my book. Thanks for having me in your podcast studio. Are the Danes listening to this podcast?
They are.
In English, they're okay with all this English?
I mean, at this point,
you do some in Danish and some in English, or
we are
all in English.
Right now, we are converting a little bit because I'm moving to Costa Rica, which, okay, you know, yeah. Or actually, when this comes out, I am in Costa Rica.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah.
Wow! And you'll continue the podcast in Costa Rica?
That's the plan.
Yeah,
that's the plan. But you know, it's I mean, as I spoke of earlier, you know, my journey has been with this project, Imperfect on Purpose, which is basically the story of my life, that actually accepting that I am enough, that I am imperfect, and doing that on purpose has made me who I am. Mm. So I believe in that. I believe in that everyone should just be who they are and accept that everyone is imperfect, and do that on purpose and then go on. And now, as I said, we're moving into a new kind of period of our lives.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, I'm very fascinated right now with life choices and purpose. Choices and purpose. So, and then, I mean, we're going to be in a, I mean, this is why we're moving, is to do some active choices for us as a family, but also for the kids, you know, and be amongst some like-minded people who also want to revolutionize the world.
And a lot of monkeys and parrots and crabs.
And snakes.
Then snakes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're bringing that little fluffy dog that you saw before.
Your dog is not going to last 6 months out there. It's going to get devoured by something.
He's a snack.
Yeah.
He's just a snack.
He's a delicious Danish snack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To some snake.
Exactly. Yeah, or a leopard.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. I mean, it's harder to bring a dog into Costa Rica than it is to bring a human being into Costa Rica, let me tell you.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Do you like a quarantine and stuff like
that? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he, you know, he's like a little fluffy.
Yeah, tiny 13-year-old little rascal.
He doesn't have anything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or does he?
I love that. I love that you're bringing him. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rain.
That was my conversation with the incredible Rain Wilson. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I really love Rain. He is a great person and I love his ideas. Check out the reels on the different social platforms and my homepage, lassevive.com. Thank you for listening and have a beautiful day out there. Memento mori. Live from the heart. Ciao.